It's been my distinct privilege tonight to be asked to introduce our distinguished speaker. I had a very nice introduction prepared, and in view of the events that have transpired this afternoon, I think that perhaps it's necessary to scrap that introduction and to say something else. I think that in view of the events that have happened today with the President's announcement that he will not run for re-election, that a certain amount of credit must be given to the events perhaps that have helped to create this particular kind of environment on the part of the President to make his to change his mind and to alter the course of American political history. I think that a certain amount of credit must be given to our distinguished speaker who is going to address us this evening. He and he alone, along with Senator Morse, were the only two senators to have voted against the Tonkin Gulf resolution, and he, above all of the others, has been most vociferous in his opposition to the present American policies in Southeast Asia. And I think that he has certainly been one of the voices crying in the wilderness and has brought this country to the point now where we can begin to reassess a position that at one time perhaps no one thought was possible for us to be reconsidering. Quotation of Robert Frost, which I think depicts the position of Senator Greeney. Robert Frost wrote, "I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that."
Well, this dramatic and largely unexpected announcement by the President really opens the way to peace. The curious fact that an hour before this broadcast began, I was being interviewed by Tom Snap for Jessens, and he asked me whom I was going to support for the presidency in November. And had I made up my mind? And I said, no, I couldn't possibly state now who I was going to support because so many things might happen. Well, he said, aren't you going to support Johnson? I said, well, he may not run again. I was just an hour ahead of the news. Well, this is a wonderful thing because it does open the way. The President has ordered the bombing by the air planes and by the fleet to stop, except in the case of this one group that's surrounded there. And I hope that the next step will be a request for a complete ceasefire. I think if he ordered a complete ceasefire on the part of the Americans and our South Vietnamese allies, and made a similar request of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, he would get it. And then with that pause, assuming that there would be no offensive action, I think we could get negotiations within a matter of a very few days. And I think that's what we must all work for. Now, the political situation, of course, has been profoundly changed. We know that who some of the candidates are going to be. And I think the important thing now is to focus on them and see how specific they can be in their proposals to get us out of this mess. Richard Nixon, who will undoubtedly be the candidate of the Republican Party, says he has a way to peace, but he isn't going to tell it until after he's elected. Well, that's hardly very satisfactory. The time for them to tell it is right now when they're seeking our votes. And I think that when Bobby Kennedy comes to Sitka next week at the Democratic Convention, I hope that he will submit to some questions and spell out specifically what he intends to do. Because to date, neither Bobby Kennedy or Gene McCarthy, who have taken a dissenting view, haven't been at all specific of how they're going to do it. I think there are very definite ways in which it could be done. I proposed one 2 or 3 weeks ago in which I simply said that the President should immediately notify all that there would be a ceasefire, ask the opposition to do it, request the Thieu and Key government to form a new government which would include all the non-communists who had been excluded from participation in the election, many of whose leaders he jailed, form a new government which would include all these elements, an immediate start negotiating with the Viet Cong, and announced that as soon as these negotiations, this new government had been formed, we would supervise elections, but there would be no more military activity, and that as soon as these elections had been held and the negotiations begun, we would gradually phase out our troops. And in the meanwhile, he would request Congress to make arrangements so that any who wished to leave, who felt unsafe, would be repatriated either in our own country under special immigration laws or in other countries if they chose. That would be one specific way in which we could stop the killing, which I think is the essential next step. There's no reason why we should slaughter any more either of our American boys or the thousands of innocent people who have been the victims of our bombing. But I think this is a very hopeful situation. Now, we're not out of it by any means. The president, at the same time that he announced his purpose not to accept renomination, did not really alter the policy except with a temporary cessation of this bombing, so that we still confront a situation where there will be a good deal of pressure on the part of the Hawks and the military to continue as we are doing. But I think that the way is open now to peace, and I think that's very important. Now, I was originally scheduled to talk to you about the draft. I have, on two occasions, have proposed amendments to the Draft Act. They didn't get very far. They were that no draftee should be sent to Southeast Asia without their consent. And the reason for that was that the draftees are subject to a unique discrimination as against all the other men who are in combat. When a man volunteers for service, and of course originally when he enters the Army, the Navy, or the Air Force or Marine Corps, he enters voluntarily. They accept an obligation to go where the Commander-in-Chief sends them. And even if they don't like the war, they've accepted that obligation and they've got to go. We may sympathize with their opposition to the war, but they've made that commitment. Now, the draftees have had no such choice. I'm convinced that this amendment would have passed, and I think we should still press for it, assuming that the war doesn't end very soon. I think perhaps half the draftees, this is just a conjecture, would go to Vietnam. And I deduce that from the fact that I know a number of young men who have volunteered to go down there, and not volunteered in order to get out of fighting either. I have a grandson who volunteered to go, and he chose the paratroopers, which is one of the most active branches of the service. He felt he ought to go, and he wanted to go, and others would. But it would be a tremendous vindication of our professions of freedom and our unwillingness to compel people to fight against their will in a war which most of the young people who studied it consider utterly indefensible, immoral, and monstrous, a view which I frequently expressed and which I now reiterate. And I think this is one of the questions we should put up to Bobby Kennedy. Now, Bobby Kennedy supports the draft, and in answer to questions said he approved of the jailing of people who didn't want to take the draft. I think one other amendment to the Draft Act we could properly seek is to allow conscientious objection to a particular war. Now, in my view, this war is entirely different from the wars in which we've engaged in my lifetime. I was a strong supporter of World War I and World War II because in those cases, I thought that the safety in the United States was in jeopardy, which in no sense it has been by what happened in Southeast Asia. And even in the Korean War, the situation was quite different, because there we fought under all the legality that was available at that time. We fought under a United Nations banner. We fought with the sanction of the United Nations. The troops of 11 other nations were fighting side by side with us. In addition to that, there had been overt aggression from the North. The North Koreans had crossed the 38th parallel. There was no such aggression in this war, despite the frequent statement that we're fighting aggression. And finally, and third, the South Koreans, the ROKs, wanted to fight, all conditions which are not present in the present conflict. So I think in those situations, it was understandable that there wasn't the far-reaching opposition to those wars at the west of this one, which I think is fully justified. I think the president's resignation may head off a tremendous civil unrest during the next year here. I think it opens the prospect of ending this war soon and of turning our attention to our pressing and overdue domestic problems, which I consider our first responsibility. I think the whole idea of going into Southeast Asia was entirely wrong. There was no justification for it. If you go by the propaganda, which has been pretty well sold to the American people, it was not true that we were asked by a friend nation to come in and help it repel aggression. The record is completely bare of any such request. We asked ourselves in, and we barged in unilaterally into a civil war, which we had a large part in precipitating. And when we started bombing north and south, it is we who became the aggressors. And the reason we've kept up this myth of aggression is that we do not want to admit that we're in a civil war. And we're fighting it all alone. The premises have completely altered. Jack Kennedy, in the closing weeks of his life, said it's not our war, it is their war. We can help them, but they've got to win it. We've taken over the war. Now, the second justification, in addition to saving this little nation for democracy and freedom under a couple of rulers who are tyrannical and oppressive and who have no concept of democracy. Marshall Key, when interviewed when he first came into public life, who his heroes were, said, "I've only one, Adolf Hitler." It's a corrupt government. Corruption is rife all through South Vietnam. And our boys are down there fighting to uphold this corrupt regime, which in part accounts for the fact that there have been so many desertions from the South Vietnamese army. 96,000 in 1966 and 110,000 last year. And there is no excuse for our being there whatsoever. Now, when it is alleged, on the other hand, that we're stopping communism, the fact is quite to the contrary. We're helping communism. To date, neither the Russians nor the Chinese have committed a single soldier to combat, yet we are bleeding to death, bogged down, fighting a small peasant people, converting the people who are supposed to be opposed to them to communism by our actions, by our burning, by our bombing, by our destruction of villages, and the making of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of refugees. And so I think that this is a situation that we can hopefully look forward to as offering a prospect for complete change. But I think it's very important that we focus on all the prospective candidates and find out just exactly what their plans are while they seek the support of the American people in the next election. I would say parenthetically that I think, of course, the possibility of Nixon is unthinkable and horrible, and we've got to... We've got to find our hope somewhere within the Democratic Party, which is the only party that has shown any real dissent during these difficult years just past. I mean, whatever dissent there has been, with the possible exception of Mark Hatfield, who came in after the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, whatever dissent there has been within the Democratic ranks. While they haven't all dissented with equal vigor, that has been the place where there's been a desire for a change in policy. And I think under those circumstances, let us hope that some one of the Democratic candidates will have a real, workable, and immediate program for getting us out of this inexcusable mess in which we're sunk. Now, that's a very brief summary, but I'd be very glad to answer any questions anybody would like to ask. Yes. I think it would be well if you came up here so that we could all hear your question.
Everybody will be able to hear it from here.
Okay.
Except I wonder who is likely to be running now that Johnson says he will not.
Well, obviously, Bobby Kennedy is way ahead. He's been very active. He jumped immediately after Gene McCarthy's good showing in New Hampshire. And he had the remnants of a good organization left over from the presidential campaign of his brother John, and he's jumped into it immediately. He's coming up to Sitka next week with an entourage of 60 newspaper men and 20 others, and he's obviously very active. Now, I imagine that Gene McCarthy, who can properly claim credit for being the first one to break the ice, will also not want to drop out. And I suspect that Hubert Humphrey, being the vice president, will also want to be considered. I would say that in all probability, the race will be limited to not more than those three. And I think that gives us a considerable choice. I think there are others who are fully qualified, but they haven't shown any particular interest in running.
Johnson chose this particular timing rather than leaking it to the press and managing it.
Well, I think he saw the handwriting on the wall. I think he felt that things were going from bad to worse, that the country was in an uproar, that the Senate was rambunctious, that they wanted to be consulted if more troops were going to be sent down, that there was a prospect of a very hot summer with a lot of riots, that the gold situation was critical, and that things were collapsing all around him. And I think this was a very wise decision on his part. I think it was an act of great statesmanship, and I think he deserves full credit for it, whatever may be the combination of motives that led him to do it. Yes?
Sir, in...
A little louder, please. Stand up so we can all hear you.
Period 59 and 63, you came to the Kodiak High School twice, and you promised us a swimming pool, and I was wondering...
Well, I believe in self-government. Now, the people of Sitka got themselves a swimming pool. Why haven't the people of Kodiak got enough gumption to get it for themselves? Any other questions? Yes.
What course of action would you say the U.S. should presume if the North Vietnamese or any other, or the Viet Cong, do not come to the negotiating table now that the bombing has been halted in North Vietnam?
Well, I think we should get out. Yes.
Do you favor abolishing the draft, and aren't we the only free country that still has a draft?
Well, I think that abolishing the draft would be much better than maintaining it. But I think the alternative that I propose is a halfway measure. I think that we should get away with the draft. I think we should have a professional army composed of volunteers who are adequately compensated so that it could enlist the number of people. And I think if we would abdicate the role of being a global policeman, we wouldn't need such large armies and we wouldn't need the draft. As long as we feel we've got to run the whole world in places where we're not needed or not wanted, we're going to need these large armaments. But I think if we came home and took care of our pressing and overdue needs here. Any other questions?
Do you think that there is existence committees that can bring about a negotiated peace without American participation in Asia?
Well, I don't think we should be in Asia at all. And I think it's going to be much more difficult for us to negotiate the peace unilaterally. I think we should get a group of nations to join us in negotiating. I think it's going to be very difficult for us with the natural pride that goes in and admitting defeat and the possible hawkish elements in our military to arrive at a satisfactory settlement.
Will it result in the total erosion of commitments we have in the peripheral areas of Vietnam in terms of military and economic aid?
Well, I don't consider that we have any commitments there. The only commitments that I know of that were made by President Johnson during the campaign, when he said not once but a number of times that he wouldn't send American boys to fight where Asian boys should be fighting. And on that basis, he was elected. Yes?
Well, sir, don't you think it's a little bit naive to believe that terrorism and aggression will cease?
Well, what's naive?
Don't you think it's a little bit naive to believe that terrorism and aggression will cease? Vietnam just because we withdraw our troops?
I don't get your question.
Sir, don't you think it's a little bit naive to believe that terrorism and aggression in Vietnam will cease just because we withdraw our troops?
Well, I think you're going to get terrorism of a kind in all parts of the world. We've had terrorism in the ghettos of the United States. We've had violence, we've had aggression. taken no part in the war of liberation for his own people, installed him through a rigged election as the ruler of that country, and when he became oppressive, started jailing hundreds of people without any trial, some of them being tortured in prison, a civil war broke out. And we call that aggression. And I think that the tactics that were used by the Viet Cong are very objectionable. They have assassinations. I don't think they're any different morally from killing thousands of people from by bombing from the air. I think it's just a different kind of barbarity and atrocity.
Senator Greening has been called to the telephone, and he'll be back in a few minutes, so if you just want to relax for a couple of minutes, he'll be right back.
Could I have your attention, please? For those who want to campaign for Senator Greening, will they please contact Dr. Webb King?
Yes.
Sir, do you have any offhand comment on your feelings about marijuana?
I have never tried marijuana, so I haven't any opinion on the subject. I think it's a good thing to keep away from.
To kind of get a little closer to home, what is your stand on the Rampart's dam deal or whatever it is?
I'm for it.
Reasoning for it, but I've heard quite a bit of opposition to it.
Well, we need large quantities of low-cost power, and Rampart would supply the largest quantity of low-cost power available on any hydro site under the American flag. One of the great problems we have in Alaska is the high cost of living, and getting large quantities of cheap power would be one way of bringing down the cost of living. Most of our power is now derived from imported fuels. We have to be brought here at high cost. Rampart would generate quantities of power at approximately 2 mils at the bus bar. Under modern methods of transmission, it could be transmitted to any part of Alaska, to tidewater, at maybe half a mil more, 2.5 or 3 mils, and I think that's very desirable. And the objections, I've heard the objections that it would be destructive of wildlife. I don't share that view at all. I think those who say that prove to be very wrong prophets in the case of the Kenai Peninsula when they prophesied death and destruction to the moose if there were any oil drilling there. Well, as a matter of fact, the moose have multiplied. They've gone all over Alaska since we started drilling down there. And this has supplied a tremendous source of revenue to the territory, the state, which would have been bankrupt if it hadn't been for oil. Well, the same people opposing Rampart opposed this drilling with the same vehemence, and they prophesied all these dire consequences, none of which have developed. And I think that with a little imagination, they would find that the Rampart Dam, far from being destructive of wildlife, would actually enhance it. With a lake back of the dam, you could have a fine inland commercial and sport fishery, and I think there'll be plenty of room for the ducks. I think that those are my reasons. Yes.
Why must we use hydroelectric power when we can use nuclear power at half the cost?
Well, nuclear power is still full of danger. The disposal of nuclear waste has not been solved yet, and I think that's a serious problem. And so far, at least at the present time, the costs of nuclear power are not lower than the cost of hydropower. And if we can dam a river that is flowing to the sea, that in a way is a form of conservation, if it doesn't have other adverse consequences. Yes?
What steps do you think should be taken for the violation of foreign fishermen in the coastal waters of Alaska?
Well, I have taken the position that we should not encourage foreign fishermen to fish off Alaskan waters. We can't prevent it. They can fish outside of the 12-mile limit. But I was somewhat shocked, but not too surprised, when I found that our aid program had very heavily financed Korean fisheries with gear, with ships, with training, with the obvious intent of having them come here and compete with our fishermen. And I don't think that's a wise policy. I don't think why we should spend our dollars to urge competition with our fishermen who are having a difficult enough time anyhow. So that my view and my effort will be to prevent any further subsidization by our tax dollars, the dollars we spend are always our tax dollars, to help foreign fishermen compete with ours. I think our fishermen are having a difficult enough time as it is.
What is your opinion on the sale of lumber to Japan?
Well, I think the lumber should be processed before we send it. I'm opposed to the sending out of round logs. What we do now is a partial processing. We square them, and that gives a little employment locally. That's about as far as we have gone, and I think that's a wise policy. Yes?
You stated we have no commitments in Southeast Asia. Do we have any commitments in Asia, the rest of Asia, in Africa, in Europe, or anywhere else in the world? Would you call yourself then an isolationist?
Well, I'm not afraid of a title. I'm not afraid of a label. If isolationism means taking care of our own problems first, our burning, pressing problems, getting rid of unemployment, seeing that everybody gets an education, getting rid of the slums, doing all the things we should do. If that's isolationism, then I'm an isolationist. Yes. Well, it was developed when the facts came out that we were tricked into this war, that far from being, as was alleged at the time when President Johnson asked for a vote, which would give him the right to use the all the force of the United States as he saw fit, out of which all this escalation has stemmed, we were told it was an unprovoked attack on an American vessel peaceably cruising in international waters. The facts were it was not. It was a provocation on our part. We were taking part, certainly in the view of the North Vietnamese, in a raid on the North Vietnam coast by the South Vietnamese, and there was no justification whatever for the misrepresentation that was given to the Congress. If the Congress had that information, which we now got after the many lives have been lost, they never would have voted the Tonkin Gulf resolution.